This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This episode of On Brand is brought to you by my new book, Brand Now, How to Stand Out in a Crowded, Distracted World. Many former On Brand guests are already raving about Brand Now. Jay Baer calls it the quintessential guide to modern branding. Stacey Grissom of BarkBox says Brand Now provides practical tools and a helpful framework for building a brand both online and off. Learn more, get special extras and additional resources at brandnowbook.com.
Welcome to On Brand, a podcast for brand builders by brand builders. Here's your host, Nick Westergaard of Brand Driven Digital.
Hey, brand builders, have we got a show for you? This week's guest is Chris Savage. Chris is the co-founder and CEO of Wistia, a web-based video hosting solution built for businesses. After graduating from Brown University, Chris and his co-founder, Brendan Schwartz, started Wistia in Brendan's living room in 2006. Chris founded the company with the goal of helping businesses effectively market their products or services more creatively through video. Recently, Savage and Schwartz turned down an offer to sell Wistia and took on $17.3 million in debt instead, which allowed them to buy out their investors, gain full control of Wistia, and take the path less traveled in the tech industry. Chris, welcome to On Brand.
Thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
Well, man, your bio ends with a bang there. I mean, we talk on the show a lot about storytelling and why story is so compelling. And in a very short bio, we have the founder's story of starting a business in a living room, and the rising action, and then all of a sudden, this great point of tension of turning down an offer to sell, taking on debt, and doing great things in a different way as well. You can't write this stuff. Someone's listening and thinking, this is a Netflix series or something.
You know, we didn't set out with a goal of heightening drama, but. But I get it.
As long as no one gets hurt.
Yeah. It's been a whirlwind, I can tell you that. But all good. So, I'm excited to tell the story. It's a story that I didn't expect to be telling. Even the debt stuff, I never thought we'd raise debt. I didn't really understand what debt was. Like, I didn't understand that as even an option. And, you know, I think it's actually been so helpful for us in terms of letting us be who we want to be, taking the risks we want to take, owning the success and failures of the business in a real way. And, you know, I mean, so far, so good. It's been about a year since we took that on and did the buyback. So I've seen a lot of change happen, and it's exciting. And that's why I'm excited to tell the story.
That's awesome. So with that in mind, I don't know that many completely follow the debt step there. I mean, most of us know what it means to start a business in a living room, and we'll talk more about the business in a bit. But what does that mean for the business, yeah. and what does that allow you to do moving forward?
Yeah. So, I mean, like many companies, we didn't really know what we wanted to be. We just knew we wanted to build something. And along the way, we made many decisions. And most of the decisions that you make in a company are reversible. I think it's like the Jeff Bezos line that's like, you have to look at decisions as a doorway. And if it's a door that only goes one way, like if you go through, you can't come back, then right. You have to treat the decision-making process really differently than if it's a door you can go through and just come right back. And we'd raised $1.4 million in two angel rounds in 2008 and 2010. So $1.4 million total. And we did that to grow the company. We had a great opportunity. We had customers that were signing up. We had big companies that were trusting us. And we needed help, honestly. I mean, I think I was 24 when we did the first raise, and my co-founder was 25. We had no experience working for any other companies, really, for the most part, before Wistia. And we had this big opportunity. We felt like we needed help. So we raised money so we could hire people before we could afford to otherwise. Went on our merry way, and then eventually found traction. Like, we built a product that people liked, some people loved. We were able to make a business model that worked, and we were able to scale the company. And that seems like that's usually the whole story. You do that, and then hopefully you sell the company if that's your goal, or you build a big business if that's your goal. But one of the things we didn't understand is that when we had raised that angel money, we'd gone through one of those doors that's really hard to go back through. Mm-hmm. And you've set up an expectation for investors who want a return. And fairly so. Like, they gave us money, and it's hard to get money. So they gave us the money, and then they're like, hey, the company's doing well. I want money back.
Right.
It's like the other side of the story that we don't often tell, or we tell it as like, the company went out of business and the investors lost their money. But like, what do you do if the company's successful and you don't want to sell? And we were faced with the option to sell the company. We've been faced with that option actually a number of times, fortunately. But this happened about a year and a half ago. And for the first time, it was a very real amount of money. There were a number of parties interested in buying the company. And actually, to be totally transparent, Brendan and I were not having that much fun at that moment. And so it seemed pretty logical. Like, why don't you just sell and get off the train? But we realized that if we sold, we would try to go back to building what Wistia was. Like, we would try to go back to build another creative company. We knew our space well. There's all these other things we wanted to do in our space. But we'd have to build a new brand. We'd have to build, like, we knew the people we'd want to hire, like, they're sitting around us. And so we realized, even though it seemed a little crazy, hey, maybe we actually shouldn't sell this company. And maybe it'll be more fulfilling for us if we build it over the long term. But if we do that, we're going to have to do right by our investors and our employees. And actually, it's going to be misaligned with what they want. So we decided we didn't want to sell and looked for a bunch of different options to get investors' money back, to like basically try to go back through the door. And there's a lot of options: growth capital, family office money, all these different things. But most of them still were opening up another door. Like, you'd go back through one door, and then there's another door sitting next to you now that you went through. And there's another group of people that are going to need a return, and they're going to need it in 3 years or 5 years or 10 years. But we've already been doing Wistia for 12 years, and I love it so much that it just seems like I can really see myself doing this for another 10 to 20 to 30 years. And so that's when we hit on this idea of debt. And so debt would let us buy out more of the company, give a return to investors, and also tell employees, like, we're not planning to sell. So if you want to, you can sell your options at the same price that investors are selling, and we'll switch the company into profit sharing. And so basically the debt let us do that, and we did that last November.
Wow. That's it is kind of an amazing story, and I think it's good because it's a story that is striking, but it's one that you have to really listen to kind of fully understand all of the ins and outs of it. I love the point in there that realizing kind of that moment of truth that if you did sell, you'd end up building something like what you were selling. So yeah. calls into question kind of everything that preceded that as well. So, and I would say, if I had to guess, maybe I'm wrong, but another topic we talk about with strong brands here frequently is employee engagement. And yeah. I think kind of the buy-sell startup culture a lot of times sometimes burn some of the people that have worked hardest on bringing the brand to life. And I would guess, maybe I'm wrong, that really had an impact in a positive way on employee engagement with the brand.
Totally. I mean, I think it's, you know, it's interesting when you, in the early days of building a company, especially if it's a tech company and you're giving people options, you're basically saying like, earn less salary and I'll give you options.
Yeah, that's the code.
You don't know how much it's going to be worth. That's why it works, right? Like, I don't know how much it's going to be worth. You don't know how much it's going to be worth, but imagine how much it could be worth.
Right.
So there's this problem that occurs in a lot of tech companies that like people don't really understand options. And there's a strike price, which is that means that's the price that you have the option to buy the option at. That's why it's called an option. Then there's the value of the company. And then there's like if there are preferred shares and liquidation preferences. It's confusing, really confusing stuff. And what we had seen actually is that we'd hired a number of people over the years who had been burned at other companies where they went in, someone gave them a lot of equity, the company is sold, and they're like, what? This is what I get? Like, and or the company hadn't been sold and had failed and they'd earned way less when they were there, even though they'd probably added tons of value. And so what happened with us was when we communicated this, people were excited and confused. In particular, confused because what the hell is debt? Like, I think it's like a company being in debt seems like a bad thing because a person being in debt seems like a bad thing.
Right.
And it took a lot of explaining and helping people see like, hey, this is how you can buy a house. Like if you want to buy something that you can't afford yet, you go and someone looks at the fundamentals of your financials and they give you an interest rate and they let you buy this house. And if you do well enough to keep paying your mortgage, you end up owning that asset. And it's very similar to what we were doing here. And in return for more fully owning Wistia, it meant that we had complete control. And so from an employee engagement standpoint, there were some people who honestly were quite afraid and left Wistia because they thought that it meant that like debt meant that we were a sinking ship. Like right. Literally someone said that to me at some point, like, oh my God, Wistia is a sinking ship. And then if you were to fast forward 6 months after it happened, I've never seen employee engagement higher because the people who are here know why they're here. They know what they want to do. They're excited about being part of a creative company. They're excited about taking risks. They're excited about being profitable. They're excited about the tangible control that they can have over the business. And so it definitely it created a dip, and now it's improved unbelievably, like more than I ever could have imagined. And I learned this lesson actually, that just the power of focus. You know, when you have something like debt where you're, or if you're not profitable yet, you have to do everything in your power to make sure that every project you have is valuable. And it means that if you have more people, sometimes it's doing more with one project, doing it faster, doing it better, or you want to do something new. Maybe there's something you're doing that you should stop doing. And what's happened to us is we've just got crazy focused. And so the quality of the work is going up, the speed with which we're doing is going up, and the impact is going up. And it's kind of ironic because like we went into debt and now we're growing faster.
Yeah. I mean, that's interesting. I love the point that you made in there about people not understanding debt either. I think that's a kind of a key turn in all of this. In looking at your company's history, you talked about, I believe, doing this for 12 years. And in that time, I have to imagine that being in the video business has been a bit of a roller coaster, because video's always been key, but I feel like it's really moved into the fast lane of how we build our brands online today.
Yeah, it's changed so much, and there have been many what we thought were many existential threats over the years that actually turned out to be boons. I think like it's that old adage of you don't want to be in a market where you're the only company because there's no market.
Right.
And so there's been an enormous amount of platforms that used to be partners that have added video, enormous changes in how you can change in terms of the production costs of video going down, number of agencies going up, the number of different places to use video it's exploded. And what it's meant for us is that like there's more people who look at what we do, which is really, you know, our core product, Wistia, is helping you use video better on your website, right? Like it's simple in that, but it's like very fast delivery, analytics that let you see how people are performing, interactivity that integrates with your marketing stack, all the things so that a marketer can use video better. Now, that marketer might use video in lots of different, many more ways than they used to, but it ends up like informing them if they're using it on social all the time, if they're using it in internal communications, and if they're using it making video ads, then they look at a problem on their website and they're like, oh, this landing page could be converting better, or this follow-up email could be getting more engaging, or we need more people to go to this webinar or whatever, and they start thinking about using video to do that. And so the irony is like, well, there's way more competition. It actually makes it easier to figure out like what we do well, and it makes it easier for people to sign up and use Wistia.
Well, it makes me think in the time, and I don't exactly know the answer to this one, but is video more or less of kind of the Wild West that it once was? It's really important, but not exactly sure what to do or how we're doing it or who can help us.
Well, I think it's kind of like email, right? So if you were one of the early companies sending email messages, like email marketing, you'd be the only one in someone's inbox and you'd be like, I'm a king. This is amazing. This is so easy, right? And then everyone got democratized and everyone started sending email and inboxes got flooded and Gmail made the promoted ad section of the inbox, and all these things happened, which you could look at that and be like, uh-oh, email marketers are screwed. And the answer is like, bad email marketers are screwed. Like, great ones, the ones who do remarkable stuff, the ones who give really useful things to their customers, they're doing better than ever. It's just that I feel like that's basically what's happened. And so I'm seeing the same thing happen in video, where it used to be like people were like, I would just put a video on my landing page and instantly it's improving. It's like, yeah, because there weren't that many companies using video to engage better on their site. Now it's like an expectation. So I think consumers want to be able to read and have the option to watch, and often have the option to listen. And if you have a complex thing you're trying to communicate, you basically have to give them all three things. Or if you're like a product page, at the very least, let them read and let them watch. And they're going to judge your brand. They're going to judge you. They're going to judge everything on like how simple those videos are, how good they are. And so it actually ends up separating the people and the companies who end up making really high quality work from the ones who don't, or the ones who make really educational stuff and really genuinely helpful stuff from the ones that don't.
You just said something that I'm sure could potentially scare a lot of people out there, because we know how big video is. We know, I think there's a Cisco report that says something like 80% of the content online by 2019 will be video. And you just pointed out, and so people are trying to jump in, trying to get more video savvy than they once were. But you hit the nail on the head that you're going to get judged by your video. So for those scared out there, what are some of the more common things that you see that folks need to level up with when it comes to their video?
So I think the most common thing is, well, first of all, the brand fear is, I'm just calling it out, but we've always had it.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I think everyone's always afraid, like, if I get on camera, will I look like an idiot? Will my will my customers trust me? Will I speak eloquently? Is my script good? What is it like? You don't know what you don't know, and so you shoot something and the background looks bad, or there isn't the right lighting, and it doesn't look like the other videos out there, and so people, it's very stressful. So it's funny, because actually this simple idea is what has driven an enormous amount of our content marketing at Wistia, is that we were making videos that looked pretty good, and then people started saying, how do you like those videos?
Yeah.
Why does the sound sound better in your video? Like, what camera are you using? And at first we're like, why are you asking us about that? Like, we're helping you do video marketing better. And like, no, I want to understand this stuff. And so we ended up making, you know, most of the content, if you go to our site, is content that teaches you how to light things better and script things better and set up your studio and get like talent comfortable. And it's actually to help people get over that barrier, that stress of like, will this help my brand or not? Soapbox, which is our second product we launched last year, which is a Chrome extension that lets you make videos. The key insight there was, we need to help people get more comfortable using video to communicate at work, because at home, if you have kids, you shoot video every other day. Like, there's just something, they do something outrageous and you pull out your phone and you shoot this beautiful looking video in 4K and you send it to your family, you send it to your friends and they laugh about it, or they send you back like tear emojis because there's like a, you know, a huge moment in someone's life or whatever the thing is. And then at work, we're afraid. And that's silly, because the other key piece is that authenticity still trumps everything else. So in a world where everyone's making videos and there's someone who's stiff and there's someone who seems like you can trust them, you're going to go with the person you can trust. And that comes back to being yourself. And that comes back to, you know, look at who does well in sales meetings. And it's the people who build trust. And I think it's like, how do you figure out how to get that into video? And how do you figure out how to get into video in a way that makes sense in a production style that makes sense with how you work? And that's actually kind of different for everybody, in the same way that writing emails is different. There's no one hard and fast rule. But I think if you just start working on it and you pay attention to it, you can figure it out.
Yeah, I love that. And I'm glad that I set up the segue into Wistia's content marketing, because it is great, because it's helpful. I mean, it is, when I teach about content and brand building, I always talk about content that is business centric and customer aware. And it seems like Wistia is one of the best examples that I can think of. And I have also say that in that I believe watched your lighting tutorial before, which is very helpful to get that right as well. So as we look at where video is going, what are some of the biggest questions people are asking about what's next? I mean, I'm sure there's still people listening to this that are thinking, I'm going to go find that lighting tutorial right now. So we're kind of all over the place with the questions that we have about video, but in kind of jumping to the way ahead pile of what's next and how can we be ready for it when it comes to video, what does that future look like?
So I think that we are entering into a time when it's easier and cheaper to make high quality content. Lots of people are making amazing podcasts like this one that sound good, that come out consistently, that have a niche that you focus on, and everyone who's listening knows what they signed up for, right?
Right.
That was not the case like 3 years ago. And I think that if you think about how fast that change has come, what I expect to see over the next 3 to 5 years is even more ongoing series, more content that's about holding an audience's attention as opposed to just attracting an audience.
Right.
I think it's getting harder to attract an audience because there's more competition, right? Like, content marketing is a known thing. So if you want to do content marketing, it's got to be really high quality, or it's got to be really focused on a niche that you know better than anybody else. But if you can get any audience, now what you have to think to yourself is like, how do I actually keep them coming back? How do I keep them talking about this? Or how do I think about the very long term of, I might have a weekly thing that I send out, be it a blog post, be it a video, be it a podcast. And I don't expect everyone to listen to or read or watch every one of these, but I expect that probably like once a month they will. And that's actually enough to keep the hold on that attention and then eventually create even more value from that audience. And so I think if you're not thinking about episodic content, if you're not thinking long-term about content, if you're not thinking about how you can get your organization to make high-quality content in an ongoing way, while still some of these things feel new, or people make podcasts for the sake of podcasting, they know podcasting is hot, but they don't know why necessarily. I think if you can get into that mode of like, I want to hold an audience's attention if I get it, and that audience is going to help me build a bigger audience, what do you do? And it's going to be different for each business, but it's always about finding your niche, finding something you actually care about, finding something that you can talk about and educate on, and then committing to actually doing that. And just like content marketing 6 years ago, the winners were the people who kept at it. Like, it's very simple. Like, you kept at it, you wrote enough blog posts, and you covered enough topics. Guess what? People talked about your stuff, and they told other people about it, and they went to you as a resource. And I think the same thing's going to happen, but I think it's going to be more about building discrete audiences.
Right, because I think that's what happens when you hit on a key timeline event over the past couple of years, that there's always been great content, and there's but the consistency of it and how much of it is happening consistently, I think that that raises the bar in a way that we have to make sure that we have those questions answered. You mentioned the why. The why this is here, who the audience is, what it is, what's unique about it. A lot of that stuff that makes it beyond we should have a podcast because everybody else is having a podcast now too. And I
exactly.
I think almost as all of these formats expand, we almost have to contract our strategy a little bit and think about what we can do that's different than everybody else as well.
Yeah, I think it's back to the, like, if everyone's doing it, then you know that there's probably great content out there. There's probably stuff that's more entertaining for you in the Apple Podcasts than is on Netflix.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Like, but, and it's like totally aligned with your values, how you think about the world, what you want to learn, how you want to be entertained, but how do you find that content? And if you find it, how do those people recognize that there's enough people in this world that there's a niche for everything? Like, that's right. How the internet works. Like, so figure out how to build up your niche and figure out what the approach is. And that takes experimentation, and that takes confidence, and that takes a long enough term view that each time you put something out, you're not expecting that it's going to go viral. That's like basically impossible, right? Like, what you're expecting is that you'll get a little bit further, a little bit further, a little bit further. And by the time, you know, you have something that has an episode that has 100,000 views on it, you're not surprised. In fact, the most recent episode before that had 95,000. So It's not like, oh my God, I figured it out in one go. It's a slower burn.
I love that. It would. This would be more. My father-in-law would chime in and say that there is an ass for every saddle. So, our job as marketers is to connect some of those dots. Hard to believe we are at the end of our time together. And as we wrap up, as we talk about all the great things that different brands are doing consistently with their content, Chris, what's a brand that has made you smile recently?
There's a lot of brands that have, how many can I give you?
within reason, drop a couple.
All right. I would say, the MailChimp rebrand that they just did made me smile. I love the fact that there's like a $800 million business that is acting like a, like, four person company, but like, you know, they're like taking huge risks in the style on their site, the colors they're using, and it's everything's on point. If you go look at old blog posts, every piece of content looks perfect. Everything changed at once. Everything in the app, like, it's crazy the amount of work that went into something to make it look like it just flipped one day. Like, it's not that simple. So I just love thinking about like the conviction that you have to make a move like that. I've also been really impressed with Envision. I think if you look at their blog and their approach, the content they're making, it's just getting better and better. It's compounding. Like, the quality of the content's getting higher. It's inspirational stuff. Like, I am not a designer, but I still read a lot of Envision stuff. I think that's hard to do. So I give them a lot of props for that.
Love it. And I love the MailChimp rebrand as well. That's it's the tool I use. I was just in there, and I can't put my finger on why I like it, but being a creative person, it makes me feel like a tool for creatives as opposed to just a global service provider X.
Totally. Can I throw one more plug in there?
Sure.
It'll take like 10 seconds.
Do it.
So we have a new Wistia Original series that we're launching. It actually is launching to today, the day of this recording.
Cool.
And it follows the relationship between creativity and money. So we trying to like eat our own dog food here and go bigger on content and take more risks. We worked with a production studio in LA called Sandwich Video. I don't know if you've heard of them, but they did the launch videos for Warby Parker and Slack Square and like just incredibly high quality stuff. And we gave them $111,000 and had them make ads for us at three different budgets, one at $1,000, one at $10,000, and one at $100,000. Three different ads for Soapbox, our product Soapbox. And then we actually documented the behind the scenes process, like how they made decisions, the creative freedom that they had, all of that, and are releasing an original four-part series that's like about an hour and 40 minutes long. So I would just say we'd love for people to check it out. Let us know what they think. It was a huge risk for us. So
yeah.
It would be cool, and I think it's something that this audience would care about.
Awesome. Well, I will we'll be sure to point folks in the right direction. Chris, what links, where can folks go to learn more about who you are, what you do at Wistia?
So you can check out wistia.com, W-I-S-T-I-A.com. The Learn section is where you're going to get the best view of most of the stuff we were talking about today. And I'm on Twitter at CSavage, and I also try to write what it's like to be building Wistia on my personal blog, which is called savagethoughts.com.
Awesome. Well, we will link up to all of that in our show notes. Chris, thank you for joining us on Brand.
Thanks for having me, Nick.
And before we go, I always like to flip the microphone around to our community. Recently, UX designer Larry Sickman discovered the podcast, listened to his first episode, and says that he will be listening to more frequently in the future as well. Larry, hope you enjoy what you're hearing. And a reminder, if you like something that you heard on this episode or another, or if you have a question you'd like one of our guests to answer, let me know using the hashtag OnBrandPodcast, and you may just hear your thoughts right here on the show. On Brand is brought to you by Brand Driven Digital, helping complex organizations simplify their branding and marketing to unlock growth. More, including the links we discussed at onbrandpodcast.com. Remember, you can subscribe to the show via iTunes, Stitcher, and TuneIn. Speaking of iTunes, if you like what you're hearing, head over there, give us a quick rating and review, help others find the show. Until next week, I'm Nick Westergaard, and I'll see you on the internet.
This has been the On Brand Podcast, presented by Brand Driven Digital. For show notes, links, and more, go to onbrandpodcast.com. Remember, you can subscribe to the show and leave a rating and review at iTunes and Stitcher. Thanks for listening.
You may know you're listening to this show along the Marketing Podcast Network, but did you know there are other great shows on MPN to help your business? Christy Hyler hosts a fantastic podcast called Own It. Christy, tell us more about the show.
Own It is all about celebrating women and non-binary advertising agency owners. We talk about buying out of the Boys Club of Advertising because less than 1% of ad agencies are owned by women.
And where can people subscribe?
You can find the podcast at untilyouownit.com. We're also on the Marketing Podcast Network at marketingpodcast.net. And of course, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
You heard her. Go subscribe. This podcast is heard along the Marketing Podcast Network. For more great marketing podcasts, visit marketingpodcasts.net.